Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. We will begin with an acknowledgement of a birthday, the 100th anniversary of the National Park Service. It was a century ago today that the service was established. Every year, tens of millions of people from around the world visit the 59 parks and several hundred facilities managed by the National Park Service. But all is not well. Joining me in studio is Bill Lowry. He is a professor of political science at Washington University, is the author of Repairing Paradise, The Restoration of Nature in America's National Parks, and he has worked as a seasonal park ranger at Yosemite National Park. Bill, so nice to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, Don. I've always liked your show, and happy birthday to all of us.
What was that? You always liked the show? Did I hear you correct?
Of course.
Thank you for that. You know, Bill, I note in the subtitle of your book, you talk about the restoration of nature in the parks. What's going on? What needs to be restored?
Well, the book is about several different parks where there are pretty serious efforts to try to restore natural conditions that may have been affected by policies that we had in the past. Just a couple of examples. In Yellowstone, as many people know, we eliminated wolves as predators there in the 1930s, and because of that, the ecosystem got out of balance, and so there was a serious effort in the 1990s to bring wolves back in the park. Wolves have come back, the ecosystem is somewhat more in balance, and the park overall, I think, is doing much better. You might get a different story from a cattle rancher nearby, but that's the idea.
Well, I know you're into the environmental studies and have been for a long time, right. So let's start there with regard to climate change and the impact that is having on the parks. I assume it is having an impact.
Oh, it's having a huge impact, Don, and I worry about it quite a bit. I worry about climate change in general, but you can certainly see the effects in the national parks. Just, again, a couple of examples. If by the middle of this century, if we don't do anything about it, Glacier National Park probably won't have any glaciers. The Everglades National Park probably won't have any fresh water because it'll be covered by salt water from rising seas. I spend a lot of time in the Rocky Mountains, and I see the impacts of pine beetles on the forests in the Rockies whenever I go out there. And pine beetles are a serious threat, and there are now two generations of pine beetles every summer where we used to have just one. And that's largely because winter ends sooner and comes later, and summers are hotter and drier. And that's not to say anything about the fires that we're having out west, too.
Oh, yeah, they're just incredible. And there's a little doubt, it seems to me, that the fires are a direct result of drought and climate change conditions.
I agree with you completely. And I've looked at the data, and if you graph it over time, the amount of acreage that gets burned every year from fires is increasing. And it's problematic for the parks. It's problematic for the ecosystem. It's also problematic because so many people want to live near parks and public areas now, natural areas, and those people get threatened, and so then that affects the policy.
Well, you know, it sounds to me like maybe we can do something about the beetles, but the other things, not so much.
Yeah, it would be hard to do. I think that we're going to have to do something. I think we have to do something about climate change anyway, but certainly in light of the parks, I think we need to do something about it. And there's another aspect to that too, Don, and that is that the estimates are that about half of the remaining fossil fuels in this country are found or would be available on public lands like parks. So there's going to be a lot of pressure in the future if we continue to burn fossil fuels to go into those places, the public lands and parks, and get that stuff out.
Well, that's the subject of a big debate these days.
Yes, it is.
The privatization, if you will, and bringing in outside I almost said vendors, but outside operations that, could mine for whatever is down there.
Well, privatization is when people talk about I think one thing that's great about the centennial of the Park Service is that people are making, there are a lot of discussions about what should happen with the National Park Service, and some of them are pretty radical. One of them I think that's pretty dramatic is the idea of trying to privatize the parks, and that one scares me as somebody that really cares about these places. I understand the motivation, but it's based on, I think there's some flaws in the arguments. I'm happy to go into those if you want.
Sure. No.
I think one of the assumptions is that parks are really costly and the national parks are really costly. You know, the budget for the National Park Service is about $3.1 billion a year. And just to put that in a little bit of context, that budget over the last decade is less than it was in 2005 in real dollars. That's at the same time visitation has gone up dramatically. And so what that means is the parks have less money to spend on more needs. And as a result, we've had this buildup of deteriorating infrastructure in the parks. People estimate there's probably $12 billion worth of infrastructure in the park that needs repairs.
That is something I wanted to get to. The figure I had here is $9.5 billion, but it's growing,
it's
obviously.
It's growing, yep.
The maintenance backlog plaguing the park, we're talking about repairs, infrastructure, that sort of thing.
And it's scary, too. You know, you talk to people that work in the parks, and they'll tell you, I would love to do X, Y, and Z projects, but I don't have enough money to even take care of clean the bathrooms. Mm-hmm. And so if they can't do that, then how can they spend money on ecosystem restoration?
Sure. On the issue of privatization, we've had a number of people who have, yeah, who have contacted us, and most of them are against that idea. Dennis writes, no private enterprise should own these national resources. Private enterprise would probably destroy some of the pristine nature of these places.
I do think, you know, the private market is great at providing a lot of goods and services, but national parks are not one of them. Even Adam Smith said that back in the day, said parks should belong to the crown. But I think that private enterprise, of course, is motivated and oriented towards the bottom line in a very short time period. And national parks are supposed to be there for generations to come.
Yeah, that's obviously very true. We have one writer here who and this is Bill writes, setting up something like Forest Park Forever to deal with the parks,
yeah,
which would be a combination of public-private, that sort of thing.
I think that kind of thing is worth thinking about. I think that there are public-private partnerships, like at the Arch City River, and there, mm-hmm, and I think those may have some promise. And goodness knows the Park Service could use more money, and if they can get some kind of help from the private sector in ways that don't damage the parks, I think that's great. A lot of people don't know this, but Ford Motor Company, back in the day, they're the ones that provided the red buses that go up and down Trail Ridge Road, but going to the Sun Highway in Glacier National Park. And they did it out of the goodness of their hearts, I guess. So.
Well, we have another tweet here. Hal writes, okay to privatize if done tastefully. Now, listen to this, Bill.
Okay.
It's okay to privatize if done tastefully, like Disney ride sponsorships.
Yeah, well, we'll take that as tongue-in-cheek, but I hope. But, you know, I think... I guess I worry that there would be a heavy emphasis on commercialization and things like that. You can see that in some state park systems that have that ask their parks to be more self-sufficient. And so what happens in state parks is they'll try to raise enough money in order to pay for their bills, and that means they'll put in more things like golf courses and ski resorts, which I think are fine. I like to golf, I like to ski, but I don't need to do them in national parks.
And, of course, most states are having financial problems as it is. I mean, take Missouri, for
Absolutely.
Instance. Could they take on a bite that, like this?
You know, it's a really important point, Don, and when a lot of times academics are talking about turning this national parks over to state governments, but state governments often don't have the money to deal with them, and a lot of them have actually cut the money that they've spent on state parks just in recent years by a considerable amount, hundreds of millions of dollars.
Is there any kind of study going on that you might be aware of, taking a look at this problem? Obviously, looking down the road, it doesn't look particularly good.
No, there are a lot of people that are studying these things and coming up with different proposals. You know, a colleague of mine and I at Washington University, a guy named Scott Krumenacher, what we're looking at are ballot measures to try to gauge how much support there is in the public for spending on parks. And it turns out, we have a data set that has...
On national parks?
No, this is parks in general.
Oh, okay.
Yep, sorry. But I think the dynamic is the same, that Americans really care about their public spaces. And since 1988 to 2014, 2,400 ballot measures, three-fourths of them passed. People want to spend money. They care about their public spaces.
And
they love their parks.
Polls that I've seen, national polls specifically related to our national park system,
Absolutely.
It's 65-70% in favor of supporting them.
Very
somehow.
Much so. There was an effort in Arizona in 2012. They had a ballot measure that would have turned national parks over control over to the state government. It lost by exactly that margin, 2-1.
Really?
Yeah.
Lots to talk about with regard to the national parks and,
yes.
and you know the things that we're so familiar with,
sure.
On the posters and Ansel Adams and all the
yeah,
rest
sure.
of it. But what about our arch grounds, the Jefferson Expansion Memorial? Where does that fit into everything?
I love the arch. I think you know, I'm really looking forward to when they finish the renovations and getting back down there. I enjoyed it quite a bit as it was. I thought that museum was excellent. So I think it fits in there in terms of, as we like to say, the gateway city, and the arch is a way to think about The different places you could go if you went further west from St. Louis.
Mm-hmm. But in terms of traffic down there, I mean, obviously 3 or 4 million people a year, I think, maybe even more than that.
Yeah,
typically visit.
You know, I think it's a good thing for St. Louis to do this, and I think it's good. I think it's good. It does. Even the St. Louis operation is partly a public-private partnership, and so that can be an example for the rest of the Park Service about how to do one of these things in ways that make sense. And it provides a lot of visibility for St. Louis, and hopefully it'll get a lot more attention.
Boy, if that became the template, wouldn't that be neat? Have the gateway to the West really provide the solution to a problem that so much of which exists.
It really would. And I think it's, and you know, I think most of us that live in St. Louis love the Arch. I was talking to somebody that just moved here yesterday, and they said they didn't know anything about it. They said, "What is that?" I said, "You can go up the Arch. You know, in fact, today you can go up the Arch free because it's the centennial."
That's right. I guess all the facilities all over the country
That's
are
right.
free for just today or for a couple of days.
Well, most of them just today. Yeah.
You know, I was just stunned when I read the fact, Bill, that 300 million people a year visit the national park facilities. That's the population of this country almost.
Isn't it amazing? I'll give you, I don't want to throw too many statistics out here, Don, but here's a good one. So it's actually closer to 315 million probably this year, be a record year in terms of visitation. As I mentioned, the budget for the Park Service is $3.1 billion. If you do the math, what that means is that we're each paying and we have about 300 million people here in this country. What that means is each of us is paying about $10 per year in taxes to support the National Park Service. Now, I'm going to the Cardinals game later tonight, and I'm willing to bet I'll spend more on a beer down there than I would on supporting the National Park Service. It's really an amazing bargain. And all these people that go there to visit, they get a great deal.
We are talking with Bill Lowry of Washington University about our national park system.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Back to continue our conversation with Bill Lowry in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our conversation with Bill Lowry. We're talking about that 100th anniversary. Going back to some of the problems that are being faced by the parks, what about the wildlife situation? You mentioned the wolves,
Yes. But
that's a big attraction. But by the same token, we talk about challenges and potential threats. Is that something to worry about too?
Yeah, it is. It is something to worry about. You know, one of the issues facing the parks is encroachment. A lot of people want to live near these beautiful areas, and the closer they get, the more interactions there will be between wildlife in the parks and people that live nearby. And there are some really interesting studies about just how much this is happening out west, particularly with animals like mountain lions that they don't recognize, and wolves, they don't recognize the boundary of the park, so they wander out into areas and they get into trouble, and it's not good for the animals or the people that they cause trouble with.
What about adjacent development to the parks? I mean, it seems to me that this is something to keep a watchful eye on.
Absolutely, it is. You can go to a place like the Smokies, a great park, but you go to Gatlinburg, Tennessee, it's right outside the park, and that community is spreading, it's growing all the time, and the boundaries of these parks are not determined by, they're mostly determined by political calculations, not by natural calculations, so they don't necessarily include the whole ecosystem. In fact, they usually don't include the needed ecosystem. For
is there any way to keep the Disney folks, for instance, from putting up something next to Yellowstone? Or any of them?
Mostly just local zoning laws. You know, a lot of parks, one thing that is sort of fortunate is that a lot of parks are boundaried by national forest lands, and sometimes that provides something of a buffer zone between the park and more civilized areas or more developed areas. Yeah. But there's nothing that really guarantees that. There's nothing that guarantees things right on the edge of the park not affecting the park. And they have problems with water pollution and air pollution that drifts over from communities into national parks.
Are the parks too crowded? You talk about pollution. I mean, you talk about 300 million visitors.
Yeah, you know, that people have often, they've asked this question for years about, are we loving the parks to death? And that's usually what they're driving at. They are pretty crowded and they're pretty congested. What I would like to see in parks, I don't know how many of your listeners or if you, Don, have been to Zion National Park or Denali. But both of them have a system where people park their cars on the outside, on the edge of the park, and then they ride shuttle buses into the park. It really reduces the traffic by a great deal, and I think it's a pretty good system. I'd like to see it in more parks.
Well, our own Mike Owens, you maybe remember him from his days at Channel 5, is driving a shuttle bus out of Glacier National Park. We hope to have him in on this program, but the connections between his cell phone and us are pretty tenuous.
I envy him. Glacier's a great place.
We'll see if we can... we'll see if we can get them on, but we can't at this moment. You know, getting back to the privatization thing, we've had a number of people responding to all of that. Paul emails, how about a special national tax similar to Missouri's special tax for conservation? Privatization is stupid and state control, no real control. They will dismantle the parks over time and sell them off.
You know, I really like that suggestion because I've thought about it myself. And for people that don't know, Missouri has one of the best state park systems in the country. And it's precisely for the reason that he mentioned, because we have this designated tax that provides a majority of the money that they need to manage those parks. As a result, they don't have to commercialize the parks. And I love the idea of a national tax that would support the national parks. And I bet it would get great public support.
Well, as you've indicated earlier, there is a lot of public support for the national parks, local parks. People just might buy that.
They might.
Phil is joining us from Ladue on the phone, and he's into the privatization issue. Let's hear from him. Go ahead, Phil.
Yeah, I was just thinking with regard to privatization that, you know, just take a look at the prison system in this country. They're unprivatizing it because the business of business is profit. And if, you know, if your profit margins include cutting park rangers, well, then so be it. You know, isn't that too bad? You don't have any park rangers. You can't privatize the national parks because business is in the business of business. They're not in the business of making, of retaining beautiful places for us. You know, I've been to a lot of national parks, and they're beautiful for what they are. And if you start making them, you know, with, I don't know, cocktail stands or whatever, you know, that they feel that they can make money with, they'll do it. And you just can't give them that kind of license.
Phil, thanks for the call.
Yeah, I agree. I've thought about that issue with prisons lately because it's been in the news, and I think the analogy is correct.
Yeah, we'll take other calls, by the way, and 382-8255 is our number if you'd like to get in on it. I think we might have Mike Owens with us now. Mentioned his name just a moment ago. Mike, are you there?
I am, Don. How are you this morning?
Doing great.
I guess where you are.
Yeah, well, it's nice to talk to you, Mike. I'm sure you're having the time of your life out there at Glacier National Park.
It's been a lot of fun. Thanks for asking. Yeah.
Yeah. Say hi to Bill Lowry from Washington University. We've been talking about the anniversary and the status of the park system right now. What's it like out there at where you are in terms of infrastructure and everything working smoothly?
Well, you know, they just finished a huge project to renovate the Going to the Sun Road. And that's the iconic road that goes from the west to the east through the middle of the park. And the Going to the Sun Road was a brainchild of Bill Logan, who was the first director of Glacier National Park back in 1910. And Bill Logan's plan was picked up by Stephen Mather, who was the first director of the National Park Service. And they came up with this idea of this road. And if you'll notice, many big national parks have a road going right through them. At any rate, this road was renovated, and the renovation concluded last year. It cost about $140 million, and it was money well spent. The road has been renovated. It's been kept to its historic standards. It's easier to drive. The paving is beautiful. You know, it's just a matter of time, you know, to make sure it stays that way. The Going to the Sun Road in the park is not only a national historic landmark, but it's a civil engineering landmark, so it's got a dual designation. And I think that's why they decided to spend as much money as they did. The properties, the grand lodges, right now the Park Service is renovating Many Glacier Hotel, which is the area where I'm based. And they're taking down the old walls inside and removing the knob and tube wiring, which is dangerous, and replacing it with fresh wiring, fresh plumbing. They're spending considerable sums of money in the parks right now.
These are tax dollars we're talking about?
Oh, yeah, these are tax dollars, absolutely. And thanks to America, the parks look pretty good.
You know, I was just going to say, Mike, I've spent a lot of time in Glacier, and I'm envious of you being out there right now. It's a great place. So.
Well, I took a walk yesterday, and on this very short walk, I saw a moose and her calf, a small herd of deer. You know, it's just an incredible place. It really is.
Mike, what about the ice? We hear that it's melting. We've talked a little bit about climate change and the impact it's having on our parks. What are you seeing, if anything, with regard to that?
Well, I mean, you can't see it as an individual. You don't actually see the diminishment of the glaciers. But the National Park Service will tell you that in the last 100 years, the average temperature in the park has gone up 2 degrees. And they think that between now and the year 2100, the average temperature will go up an additional 8 degrees. And you and me, that may not sound like much, but in these climates, this climate and in this elevation and in this latitude, this high latitude, it has a dramatic impact. And, you know, they're seeing things happening in the park now that never happened before. There are trees growing in areas where trees could never grow before because of the warming temperatures. The trees are moving upslope. They're moving into the subarctic, the subalpine zone and the alpine zone. And that's something that really has them concerned. But there's nothing the Park Service can do about it. I mean, they're a victim like the rest of us.
Bill is a specialist in the area of the environment. What do you make of this, particularly at Glacier, Bill? What do you know about the melting situation?
Yeah, no, like I said, I'm very concerned about it. And as Mike says, I don't think you can see it from day to day. But if you go from year to year, even 10 years ago, and then you go now, you would see a difference, I think, there right away. And I guess I'm curious, Mike, if you're seeing much of the pine beetle infestation there in Glacier that we see in places like Yellowstone and the southern Rockies.
There's a fungal infection affecting trees here, but it's not as widespread as the pine bark beetle. Mm. I mean, you go to parts of Colorado, there's no trees left on these mountainsides. Yep. But, you know, if the temperatures keep moderating, I'm sure that will be the next scourge for these mountains. You know, I mean, when this region was first examined by scientists, they counted 150 glaciers. And now we're down to 25,
whoa,
maybe 24. So in 1850, 150 glaciers. In 2016, 25, maybe 24. And they're diminishing every year. You know, the criteria for a glacier is at least 25 acres of snow area, 100 feet deep, and moving downhill. And don't expect to watch it move downhill because they move as slow as your fingernails grow. These are just alpine glaciers perched up, you know, in the cirques above, you know, above the mountains, above the valleys, rather. And, you know, they're diminishing. And one of the reasons is, quite frankly, the spring comes earlier and the fall stays longer. So instead of getting snow in the spring and snow in the fall, they're getting rain. And rain doesn't build up a glacier. And if you think this just is hurting the trees and the animals, particularly a pika, which is a small rabbit-like creature that lives in the alpine zone, think about the farmers on the east side and the west side of this park who depend upon snowfall for irrigation in the summer months. They, too, are wondering what's going to happen in the future.
Mike, you haven't lost your reporter's touch. That was a great a great report. And there you go. I mean, the evidence, Bill Lowry, that he has presented us with, the changes over the last century and a half, tells the story.
Yeah. You know, I think people need to hear these things, too, because I think they really do, as you mentioned, Don, they really do care about the parks. And if they knew just how much danger they're in from these, I think that would make a difference.
What are the crowds like at Glacier, Mike?
Huge. Absolutely big, big crowds, and they expect, you know, they say normally 2 million visitors a year. It was off a little bit last year because of a big fire on the west side of the park. I'm sorry, on the east side of the park. But they think the visitorship may be up 8 to 12% this year, and that's maybe due in part to the to the celebration of the anniversary, the 100th anniversary.
I just saw that down at Grand Canyon. That they're getting more visitors than ever there. Yellowstone has record visitation this year. I think people are going to the parks. One thing about this, we were talking about privatization, and I'm not pushing the idea, but there are some ideas from the free market that we could take advantage of, and that is people get a great bargain by going into the parks. We could charge a little bit higher prices for people to get there. Just as an example, I got my senior pass recently, I admit, and it was only $10 for a lifetime pass. It's an incredible deal, and we really could pay a lot more to go access our parks.
Mike, what does it cost to visit Glacier?
I have the slightest idea. I've got a pass that gets me in. It's an employee pass. I think it's, if you want to do a week's pass, it's $40. And that's, let's be realistic, that's dirt cheap.
It's dirt cheap.
That's nothing. Nothing. I mean, people spend more than that on coffee every week, for goodness sakes.
Yep.
A good deal.
What are they doing to observe today's anniversary?
Well, interestingly, I'm kind of out of a news loop, but I overheard conversation today that the Secretary of the Interior stayed in Glacier National Park last night and will attend a ceremony at Logan Pass. And Logan Pass is the area in the park where the Going to the Sun Road reaches its highest elevation. It's also the Continental Divide, and there's a huge big parking lot there. And I assume that's where the Secretary will have some sort of ceremony to celebrate the 100th anniversary. I won't be there. I'm in Kalispell on a mission for my company, so I can't be there, unfortunately.
Time is running out very, very quickly. Why did you decide to do this summer? Was it a bucket list kind of thing for you?
No, I was out here last summer hiking, and I ran into a red bus driver, and I was talking to him for a bit. I asked him, I said, "Do you like doing this?" He says, "Oh, it's the best. Look at my office, these mountains, these valleys. Everybody's generally in a pretty good humor. The guests on the bus, they're all on vacation. They're having a good time. What can be wrong with that?" And as a former television reporter, I get to talk a whole bunch, and I have a captive audience. It's absolutely perfect for me.
All righty. Well, Mike, we're going to let you go. I know you're a busy guy, ostensibly anyway, but we want to thank you.
Oh, yeah.
thanks so much for spending some time with us, and have a great rest of the summer out there.
I've just got about less than a month to go for me, so yeah.
Enjoy it.
Well, let's get together when you get back. I'd like to hear some of your stories.
All right, Don. Take care. Bye.
Great. You too. Bill, back to you. Our time is beginning to wind down. We can't let the time go by without you fessing up to exactly what you did when you were working in Yosemite.
Yeah, well, speaking of, Mike was talking about how much he enjoys just being out there. When I was in Yosemite, the technical term for my job was grounds and maintenance, which is a fancy phrase for I cleaned a lot of bathrooms and outhouses. And it was the prettiest place I've ever had a job like that, and it's probably the best job I ever quit.
The best job you ever quit. Well, and somebody's got to do it. I guess that's the way
it's a great place to do it. It's the prettiest place on earth, if you ask me.
Yeah. Well, there are so many pretty places in our national parks. It's just incredible. Let's keep our fingers crossed that the ways are found to keep them going and keep them as pristine as they have always been.
I agree completely, Don, and I hope everybody gets a chance to get out and enjoy the parks.
Me too. By the way, I want to just tell our audience thanks very much for all the photographs they've sent us. We've solicited them yesterday, and we've received more than 30 photos of St. Louis's favorite national parks. Go to our website at stlpublicradio.org, and you will find some very, very nice pictures. And we have a tweet here. Caitlin writes, 140 characters is too short to talk about how great national parks are. Remember waves of grain for the purple mountain's majesty above the fruited plain. America, America, God shed his grace. There you are. That paints a picture. Bill Lowry, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Don.
It's been a pleasure. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.